from bureaus worldwide. This is FSN.
Ollie Barrett there. Thank you, Ollie Barrett. It's Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. It's been a miserable old day here in Salford. Thank God we've got one another, you and me. It's the 9th of December. So it is. Welcome.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
And as usual, if you'd like to reach the program, do it through Twitter. Drop me a tweet. I'll be only too thrilled to hear from you this Wednesday. The oft-mentioned future Mrs. Allen, completely disorientated by lockdown. Saw her putting out the bins this morning. So your missus puts out the bins, Richie, yeah? Yeah, she does, yeah. What of it? What's it to you? Of course, the bins don't go out until Thursday. Everybody's all over the place. What are you going to do? You're just going to get on with it, is what you're going to do. I tell you what, dear listener, this might very well be a sad week for broadcasting, because I think my friend and your friend, the glorious, the broadcasting genius that is Kay Burley, I think Kay might have sang her last song on Sky News. This is a saga, a proper saga. It really is. Kay hasn't been into work, since Monday. She came in on Monday and then she disappeared from our television screens. Kay had a birthday party, didn't she, on Saturday for her 60th birthday. And she went out with a few, like Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. And she's off the telly as well, because they broke lockdown rules. That seems to be annoying a lot of people, because Kay was, well, she was very sharp, wasn't she, with people like Dominic Cummings and Neil Ferguson and others. But it's going to be, it's a terrible loss, I think it'll be, to the broadcasting community. Vulnerable group, the broadcasting community, if we don't get Kay back on our television screens. I'll be the worst for it, myself. There you are. Speaking of breakfast television, Good Morning Britain ran a poll on Twitter today. And the poll asked a fairly basic question. Should the unvaccinated be banned from public places? That's nice, isn't it? How lovely. Journalists, or a journalistic organisation, is asking people to say whether they think the unvaccinated should be banned from public places. We might come back to that a bit later on. In the independent media, I was speaking with several friends today about this, because I love the independent media. It makes me laugh. Makes me laugh a lot of the time. And a lot of the time, it's very useful, of course, because it provides us with research and with information that we wouldn't get. But a lot of the time, it's hysterically funny. A lot of people saying that Margaret Keenan, the 90-year-old or 91-year-old woman who got the very first coronavirus vaccine yesterday morning in a hospital in where was it? Was it Leicester? Was it Birmingham? Was it somewhere like that? And she got her vaccine. And then she was wheeled back to her ward because she's currently an inpatient. And as she was being wheeled back, she apparently gave a heart sign with her thumbs and her forefingers. But some people think that's some satanic sign. And some of you think that Margaret is a crisis actress. A crisis actress. She's not real. Jesus. Down the rabbit hole. Properly. You're so far down the rabbit hole now. And I wonder, listen, are you saying she isn't? What do you know? I know nothing. Nada niente. Not a lot is what I know. But I do know that people appear to be queuing up for the coronavirus vaccine manufactured by Pfizer and BioNTech. I don't think they would have needed to hire a crisis actress to film somebody getting the vaccine. You get what I'm saying? I don't think they were short of willing volunteers. But anyway. But for some people, nothing ever happens. Everything is staged. No real knife attacks. No real bomb attacks. No real guys driving into crowds in lorries. Everything is a hoax to some people. And, well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. saw a story in the Daily Mail today that made me laugh. You know you're living in vaudeville. Vaudeville is, let's rename planet Earth, planet Vaudeville. Story, it's a genuine story. Genuine story with a genuine headline. The headline went like this. Boy Gran. Sweet moment. Prince William says boy Gran to the Queen, his grandmother. Pulitzer Prize winning stuff in the Daily Mail today. Mad world, mad world. Right, yesterday, massive production. We talked about this extensively yesterday. I won't repeat myself. Not a lot. What I think was a coordinated media, government and NHS production, all of them working in tandem. They've called it V-Day. And that seems to have stuck because I've heard V-Day quite a few times today as well. Everybody was stationed at hospitals around the country. As I said, they applauded the old dears as they got stuck with the needle. Reporters said, oh, we're overcome with emotion. It's a joyous day. It's a time we'll remember as long as we live. V-Day. And it carried on today. But first, this morning, we learned of it this morning, but they've been talking about it all day. We learned of the very first adverse reactions to the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Here is Sky News.
Good afternoon. People who have a significant history of allergic reactions have been warned not to have the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. The warning from the UK regulator comes after two people who had the jab during yesterday's rollout had allergic reactions. Here was the chief executive of the MHRA, Dr. June Rain, speaking to the government's Science and Technology Committee earlier.
Last evening, we were looking at two case reports of allergic reactions. We know from the very extensive clinical trials that this wasn't a feature, but if we need to strengthen our advice now that we've had this experience in the vulnerable populations, the groups who've been selected as a priority, we get that advice to the field immediately.
Okay, and more from Dr. June Rain of the MHRA to come a little bit later. Over to Sky's science correspondent, then, Thomas Moore.
Well, as we understand it, these were two healthcare workers who did have a significant, in their medical history, a significant allergic response to other things, and that they actually carried these adrenaline pens, EpiPens, just in case. So we know that they would be at higher risk, and hence the precautionary message coming from NHS England and the MHRA on if you have responded in a bad way to medicines, vaccines or food in the past, then you should not have the vaccine for the time being while they carry out this investigation. And we know from the data that Pfizer released yesterday as part of the appraisal process in the United States that 5 in 1,000 people who had a placebo jab had an allergic reaction, but 6 in 1,000 who had the vaccine had a reaction. So these things do happen. It's just part of the process of having an injection, even with a dummy jab. But there does seem to be this slightly increased risk if you have had problems in the past that you might have problems with this. And certainly Pfizer has issued a statement today in which they say, as a precautionary measure, the MHRA has issued temporary guidance to the NHS while it conducts an investigation in order to fully understand each case and its causes.
In order to fully understand each case and each case's causes, allergic reactions. You might remember this from the one and only Dr. Vernon Coleman, who was on with me on this programme on Monday. He said this.
The problem is that the side effects will probably be not just infertility, but neurological allergy responses, autoimmune, increased vulnerability to viruses. There was one paper which said there was a possibility of increased vulnerability to HIV. I think that was in The Lancet. All this is going to be blamed on COVID-19. It's a massive experiment.
Massive experiment is right. They haven't got a clue. That was Vernon Coleman, Dr. Vernon Coleman on Monday. They haven't a clue what this will do to people in the short term, let alone the medium to long term. It's extraordinary. If you've had a history of allergic reaction to anything, to food, to medicine, they're now saying, don't take this vaccine. Just for a quick laugh before we move on. I must give a big shout out to Oscar Boddington. How you doing, Oscar Boddington? He's the son of my mate Joe Boddington in Chorlton. I played you this clip of Talk Radio's Ian Collins yesterday. He was thrilled that the virus, well, let me say that again. He was thrilled that the vaccine was now being stuck into people. And he said this.
The vaccine is here. It's been wheeled out today. It's like a... To me, I just look at this and think, this is such a great time to be alive for the human race, right? And I share Julia Hartley Brewer's enthusiasm for this as well, that this is just medicine and science at its very best. Some things happen. Here is a virus. Viruses will happen, by the way. Pandemics will happen every 20, 30 years, I think the stats say. And they come around with different levels of severity and different attack different elements of the human condition or the human biological system, etc. And what we can do as humans is try and fight that. And the best are on the case. And this was a global effort. And it's an amazing time, a real proud time to be a human on this planet. That we are here to kind of witness these kind of moments.
Lovely. He was thrilled, right? Ian is signing up, right? He's putting his name down, right? Jab the ever-living bejesus out of Ian, right? Well, no. Oscar got in touch and said, Richie, you missed what Collins said shortly after that.
I'm making the point about the mischief. I don't think you'd hear Richard Madeley talk about not having vaccines. But you're allowed a reservation. And I've said this all along. You're allowed to have a reservation. I probably won't have the vaccine. I've never had a flu vaccine. Don't think I need a vaccine.
What? What was that? Hang on a second now.
You're allowed to have a reservation. I probably won't have the vaccine. I've never had a flu vaccine. Don't think I need a vaccine. That would be my prerogative. But not because I think it's dangerous or going to poison me or sterilize me or do something outrageous to my brain or change my DNA or make me grow another head or even a tail, God forbid. Quite like a tail.
Wow. What kind of fuckery are you? Thank God for the vaccine, the best and the brightest of Britain. I'm glad to be alive and God bless the NHS and all of that. No, I'm not going to have the vaccine, said Ian Collins. Thanks so much, Oscar Boddington. I don't listen, to every minute of every radio programme. I'm glad you picked up on that. Proud to be British, V-Day, but I'm not having it, I don't need it. According to the Irish Times today, you might have seen this on Twitter, you might not, Irish politicians... The members of the Irish Parliament chucked the doll as TDs and Irish members of the European Parliament and Irish senators will be urged, wait for it, to pledge that they will not only take the vaccine, but that they will promote it as well. Apparently some Irish politicians have angered the government and the Irish health authorities because they were speaking to local newspapers and saying, well, I'm not having the jab. Níl. Gurdh míle maith agat. Níl. Apparently, no. Some Irish politicians saying, no, I don't want it. I don't trust it. And they're being reined in by the Irish government and the HSE in Ireland who are saying, pledge to take the vax, but also, go and promote it in your constituencies. The time is 17 minutes past five.
You shake my nerves and you... This is great, balls of fire.
Ah, Jerry Lee Lewis. What was it, Dennis Quaid? I think it was Dennis Quaid who played Jerry Lee Lewis in a film called Great Balls of Fire. And if I'm not mistaken, Winona Ryder might have been in it because he married his cousin, didn't he? Bad enough marrying your cousin, eh? But marrying your cousin when she's very, very young. What was she, 12 or 13 years of age? Not good. Not good. Jean Anne has reminded me. Thank you, Jean Anne. It's good to have friends like Jean Anne. The pledge I just mentioned with Irish politicians, whether it's Irish politicians in Brussels or Irish politicians in the Dáil, they have been asked to pledge to promote the vaccine and to take it. Now, the man behind that initiative is the leader of the Irish Labour Party. His name is Alan Kelly. So Alan Kelly, Labour Party leader in Ireland, is asking, he's been very critical of politicians who are sceptical about the vaccine, and he's demanding that everybody pledges to take it and to promote it. Well, it's been announced today that Alan Kelly's brother, runs a charity that was given $16.5 million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Alan Kelly's brother, Declan, Alan Kelly, the leader of the Labour Party, his brother, Declan, is a board member of Global Citizen. And Global Citizen was given $16.5 million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And the Labour Party leader is out demanding that people accept the vaccine and promote it. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. And thanks so much to a listener who sent me a link to a story that was on Fox 5 New York yesterday. That's the website fox5ny.com. Thank you, dear listener. Very good. An assemblywoman in New York has proposed a bill there, okay, mandating vaccination against COVID-19 if not enough New York residents voluntarily get it. Earlier this month, earlier in December, so basically a few days ago, Linda Rosenthal, who represents parts of Manhattan's West Side, introduced a bill requiring the state to safely and effectively distribute an FDA-approved vaccine in accordance with the Department of Health's COVID-19 administration program. But her proposed bill goes on to say that the state must make efforts to promote vaccination and ensure that a high enough percentage of the population is vaccinated against COVID to develop sufficient immunity. Once the vaccination program has been rolled out for a while, the Department of Health would have the authority to mandate vaccination to anyone who could safely receive it if public health officials say that New Yorkers aren't developing sufficient immunity from COVID-19. This is dystopia. This witch wants to introduce a bill that, and I mean, this will be everywhere, pretty much everywhere. In order for the vaccine to be rolled out, you will have to have a bill. But she wants to put a caveat on the bill. Yes, let's have the vaccine, but if we're not reaching herd immunity, or if we don't get enough people taking the vaccine, we could then mandate it for anybody who can safely have it. Now, what would happen at that point is anybody's guess. Would you have a knock on the door from the Boys in Blue, or the army, or a health worker demanding that you take an appointment and show up at a certain time to have your vaccine? I don't have the answer to that. 23 minutes past five. That's FoxNY, Fox5NY.com. That story went live last night. Let's talk for a moment about June Rain of the MHRA. The MHRA is the allegedly independent regulatory body for medicine in this country. Now, she appeared before the Commons Science and Technology Committee this morning. We heard from her a few minutes ago about the adverse reactions in two NHS workers. So this morning she's in front of the committee. Greg Clark is the MP chairing the committee, and he wants to know why two doses of the Pfizer vaccine when in the United States the FDA has recommended that one will be enough. That's a bloody good question, isn't it? We should be hearing from June Rain now. Let's try that again. The best laid plans. June Rain, Greg Clark, asking the questions.
Going back to the Pfizer vaccine that you have approved, the Food and Drug Administration in the US says that the Pfizer vaccine offers significant protection after one dose. Does that conform to your findings, your experience of evaluating it?
Certainly, there is immune protection after one dose, but we are looking to optimal protection, and that is why the authorization in the UK for use of this vaccine looks at the two doses 21 days apart, because we know that there is a very good level of protection 7 days after the second dose.
Right. So we know that there's protection from one dose. It's a question of how much higher it is after two. I see.
Absolutely.
And just for completeness, we talked about two of the vaccines. Can you just give us an update on where you are with the Moderna vaccine?
Right. before we find out about the Moderna vaccine, the FDA says one jab is enough. I wonder, has any pressure been brought to bear on the UK to have two jabs, an initial one and then a second one 21 days later? I don't know. Say by a mutual friend of Pfizer and a friend of June herself, the computer geek maybe? I don't know. It's all speculation. Right, so the Moderna vaccine then, when will we have that one?
We are engaged with the developers in the rolling review, and in the same way are expecting to have a mature data package in the coming week or two, and therefore we will be mobilising the same parallel teams to deliver a rolling review outcome as soon as is possibly able to achieve.
Thank you. And finally for me, before I turn to Jeremy Hunt, this is a lessons learned inquiry, as I described at the beginning. You've been good enough to come today to give us your experience on something that is very live. But the development and the approval of vaccines has clearly been a crucial part of this response to the pandemic. Reflecting back, if you have even the ability to do that, given the immediacy of your work, are there any lessons that can be learned, you think, already, given your long experience as a medical regulator, for how we might approach the development of vaccines and other drugs in the future?
Mm. What has she learned then? Listen very, very carefully.
You've learned very important lessons about the absolute imperative of engagement with developers in a proactive way from the earliest stages, about the importance of independence and our expert advisory committees being able to bring in expertise and to strengthen the assessments that we deliver. And I would say that when we think about the future and the important role of vaccines in our switch to a preventive healthcare system, that these vital therapeutic tools should be part of our national infrastructure. And therefore, at the agency, we look forward greatly to the VMIC, Vaccines Manufacturing Innovation Centre, coming on stream, that our own inspectors and experts in the field have been working to help establish. So very important lessons, and we will build from these for the future to enable the UK to have access to the best therapeutic options, vaccines that are so important to change health.
Now, I know you did catch that because you don't miss very much.
When we think about the future and the important role of vaccines in our switch to a preventive healthcare system, that these vital therapeutic tools should be part of our national infrastructure.
Vaccines, vital therapeutic tools, should be part of our national infrastructure as we move to a more preventative type of medicine. And this is where I see it going, and I'm not the first person to say this. But I think in the very near future, we're going to be told that there are more and more and more vaccines coming, not into development, but actually coming out. Vaccines that you're expected to take. Against what, you might say? Well, I think you can imagine off the top of your head anything. Vaccines against certain types of cancer. Vaccines against diabetes. Vaccines against obesity. Vaccines against asthma, vaccines against sore throats, vaccines against gastroenteritis. Honestly. And you'll be encouraged to take them. You'll be encouraged to be a good citizen and not to be a burden on the rest of society. And that's where the social crediting thing comes in. And you know me now, we've known each other long enough. I don't take any credit for any of this. I've been listening to learned men and women telling me about these things for a number of years, for a good number of years. But I've listened and I've looked beyond what they've told me, and they're right. You'll have to maintain your body mass index in the near future, or certain activities, certain luxuries, I think, will be denied you. That's what preventative means, I think. I think it means controlling what we ingest, controlling everything else. It's just deliciously dystopian. There's that word again, isn't it? Imagine part of our national infrastructure, vaccines, will lead the way as we move to preventative health. And you'll be denied healthcare in the future if it's deemed to be your own fault. Your old ticker is playing up a bit, is it? Bit of angina, maybe. But you're a fat bastard. We told you to take the vaccine, or we told you you couldn't eat this or you couldn't eat that. We told you you had to report every morning for calisthenics. You had to be seen on your Peloton machine or something like that. You see that fucking thing, I'm sorry for swearing, and I am, that Peloton thing. Come on, Peloton, I got you. Imagine we're moving into a world where you've got an exercise bike in front of your fucking television. And it's hooked up to Wi-Fi. And you've got Lycra on your body in your fucking living room on a program like Peloton. And you're pedaling away like your life depends on it, while some skinny bitch in a leotard somewhere in Chicago is screaming fucking slogans at you. That's where we are. And in the near future, you'll be expected to participate in shit like that. Look at them in China in the mornings, in some workplaces. You've seen this stuff in some workplaces where they do aerobics and stuff and exercises. Be a good citizen. Have you seen that Peloton thing? What's happened to us? What's happened to us? Somebody said to me a few weeks back, it was absolutely booking it down. It was booking it down. And I was like a drowned rat in the street running my 6 kilometres. And a muppet said to me, I don't even know the guy, why wouldn't you get a, what are they called? A treadmill. What the fuck? A treadmill. We're creatures of the earth. We're supposed to be out in the elements, in the fresh air. There's nothing more wonderful. I haven't cycled in some years now. I love cycling. I don't know why I haven't cycled in some years. It's not laziness. It's not because of the car. I run everywhere. I walk to the shop. I don't drive to the shop. So it isn't the car. But I miss my bike. Isn't a cycle a wonderful thing? In the countryside. In a national fucking park. Come on, Peloton, I got you. Somebody shoot that bitch. If you know who she is. I keep seeing that ad on Sky and on ITV every day. Please disassociate myself from my previous remarks. Don't be shooting anybody. That's where we're going. We're going down that road. Your body mass index is in overweight. It's leaning towards obese. Well, you can't have an operation. Now, you might not need an operation on, I don't know, on your knees. You might need an operation on your throat. You might need an operation on your brain. No, you've got to go to the back of the queue. Why? Because you're out of shape. You're not a good citizen. Now, let's stay with June Rain, Professor Dr. June Rain from the MHRA, because she was asked by another committee member a question, and her answer was unbelievably telling. Please listen to this. The MHRA is the supposedly independent regulator for medicinal products and drugs in this country. It's supposed to be completely independent of government and of business and corporations and pharma. She was asked this question. I couldn't believe my shell-like when I heard the answer.
I wonder if you would mind just explaining to us, for completeness of the evidence that we're gathering, the importance of the role of the MHRA in allowing medical products and devices to come into use.
Our role is to, in a nutshell, enable access. But the evidence that we require is that the benefits outweigh any risks, and therefore we take every care scientifically and in terms of our robust procedures to ensure that these standards are met.
You got that, didn't you? What is the point of the MHRA, and she said,
"Our role is to, in a nutshell, enable access."
Again,
"Our role is to, in a nutshell, enable access."
I thought your role was to protect the public from bad drugs. No. So far from being a totally independent regulator, whose job is to protect you and me from bad drugs, incorruptible, apparently, as I said, independent of government and big business and big pharma, you're basically a go-between. You're a go-between. You're a broker between pharmaceutical companies and the NHS, right?
When we start,
"Our role is to, in a nutshell, enable access."
Enable access. This is the chief executive of the MHRA being asked, what is it that you do? You'd imagine the immediate answer, the speed of light, we're a public watchdog. No. Our role is to enable access, to let the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world peddle their drugs. Here's Elvis, the King, from his debut album, Mystery Train, by the King of Rock and Roll, Elvis Presley. Before I move on, I want you to hear that question and that answer again. Now, I'm not over-egging the pudding, as it were. I'm not overstating it. This is very important. There's a woman being questioned, is the CEO of the MHRA. That is June Rain. She's been asked a question in a committee hearing this morning, and her answer, I think, is the most extraordinary thing I've heard for quite a while.
I wonder if you would mind just explaining to us, for completeness of the evidence that we're gathering, the importance of the role of the MHRA in allowing medical products and devices to come into use.
"Our role is to, in a nutshell, enable access."
That's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. "What role do you play," he said, "in enabling, well, not enabling, in allowing medicines and drugs and treatments to come into use in the United Kingdom?" This is supposed to be an agency that is scrutinising to the nth degree every aspect of every medicine, sceptically, to make sure it does no harm whatsoever. What is your role?
"Our role is to, in a nutshell, enable access."
Enable access. There was a time that would have been headline news. Faisal says, "I used to cycle everywhere, Richie, in Switzerland. I started cycling over here in the UK when I moved back, but I gave it up as it's too dangerous after a couple of days of near misses." Is that right? I'm not going to argue with you there. I despair at the standard of driving in this country. It's diabolical. It really is. And not patting myself on the back, I'm somebody who's very self-critical and self-analytical, and I'll tell you 1,000 times a day that I'm not very good at this or I'm not very good at that. But I never fail, and I'm touching wood here, that I never will fail to look into my rear view and into my left wing mirror at junctions every time to make sure I see that cyclist slipping up on my left hand side, so that as I go to turn left at the junction, that I don't knock him or her into the middle of next week. But I see a lot of near misses myself when I'm driving about town. I don't know if this driving standards is worse here than anywhere else, but you certainly think it's worse here than it is in Switzerland, the Swiss. What does Patricia think of that? My great mate who lives in Zurich. How you doing, Patricia? Hi to Patrick, to Fabrizio, to Chris. How you doing, Chris? To Jasper. How you doing, Jasper? Hi to Molly. Hi to Northern Warrior. And thank you for your very kind tweet. Hi to Amanda Thompson as well. Alan Bass Ninja. How you doing, Alan, in Liverpool? How are you? Hi to Ol McCartney. Ol McCartney says this, and a few of you have expressed this to me in recent days. Richie, if I were suspicious, I could say that the very old have been given a placebo as the world looks on. The publicity would be that it doesn't kill 90-year-old people. Therefore, it's okay for everyone. So Ol McCartney says, I think they might give a placebo to the very elderly. And when they don't start dropping like flies, it is then communicated to the rest of society. You can have the vaccine, folks. It's tickety-boo. It's safe. Don't worry about that. Donkey says there's no such thing as an independent regulator anymore, if there ever was. I put some information, I put out a video last week on Facebook. It's very, very easy to link June Rain from the MHRA to Bill Gates, Billy Poison Jabs himself. It is 17 minutes to the top of the hour. We're going to hear from the chief medical officer, a bloke called Chris Whitty. I know. We won't be hearing from him for too long, but we do need to hear from him back after this.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Right, Ruth in Australia, who's a very good friend of mine, big supporter of independent radio. How you doing, Ruth? Ruth says the driving is worse in Australia. We could just descend now. We could segue into talking about women drivers and men drivers. I'll tell you a very quick story. I think I might have told you before. If I did, forgive me. I am, on occasion, I do repeat myself. It's a true story. I'm reminded of it because a friend of mine whose name is Anne. Anne is a pilot and a lovely woman, a very smart woman. She's a pilot, is Anne. And I was telling Anne my story a couple of weeks back. We were having a chat. Back in 2002, I took a sabbatical. I took a break from radio back in 2002. And I know I told you this bit. I decided to go to spend some time in Costa Rica, in Central America, obviously, in San Jose. And there I would be teaching English as a foreign language, the legendary TEFL course, which I did and passed with flying colours. I better pass it with flying colours as an English graduate, but I did. And I was also going to work for a time in turtle conservation. I was very excited with myself. Long story short, anyway, the journey was Dublin to Heathrow, and then it was American Airlines from Heathrow to Miami International, and then I was catching a plane from Miami International down to San Jose. Very quick, because I have lots to get through. I don't want to dwell on this. I got onto my plane in Heathrow, my American Airlines plane. It wasn't a 747. It was a big plane, but not a 747. 8 hours, they said. Excuse me. 8 hours to Miami International. 8 hours. And I was one of the first on. Not because I'm particularly rude or insensitive to the needs of others. It was my row was called, or my section of the plane. And I get on, and I'm fairly near the front. Very near the front. And I get on anyway. And as I'm putting my little bag in the overhead compartment thingamajig, I could see a guy was having, not a heated, but a loud conversation with a flight attendant. And he was pointing to the flight deck. Next thing, he grabbed his overhead bag and he grabbed his coat and he went back down the gangway, or the what do they call that? The arm, the corridor that attaches the plane to the terminal. And off he went. And I looked at the flight attendant and I laughed and I said, did I just witness? And she said, yes, because I'd seen through the open door to the cockpit that the flight deck was full of women, women in pilot uniforms. And the guy had asked the flight attendant, is it a woman flying the plane? And she said, yeah. And he got off the plane. And my mate Anne is a pilot. And I mentioned this to Anne and she said, Richie, that's very common. And I said, is it common? She said, it's very common, Richie. More common than you think. She said, and I didn't know this, famously or infamously, Jim Davison was on an EasyJet plane some years ago. Jim Davison now is a comedian who was very, very, very famous in the UK in the 70s and 80s, even the early 90s, you could say. Funny at times, but as we move towards a more politically correct dystopian paradigm where nobody could say anything, Davison's television career anyway came to an end. But apparently he's a bit of a misogynist. He was on an EasyJet flight, and again, the pilot was standing between the cockpit and between the passenger area, maybe saying hello to people. Davison said, is it a woman flying? He was told, yeah, and Jim ran off the plane. There you are. All right, it's 12 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is live from Salford, as it always is, Monday to Friday. The BBG, not the BBC. Let's go back to the House of Commons, the Health and Science Committee, or the Coronavirus Committee, as it has been dubbed. We're speaking this morning to Tweedledum and Tweedledee, or the Dickhead Brothers. Who are the Dickhead Brothers? The Gallaghers? No. Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer, and Patrick Vallance, the Chief Scientific Officer. Two of the biggest clowns we've ever seen on national television. There's no end to these guys. You can't go 10 minutes without seeing them on your telly. Whitty was asked about vaccines and the rollout of vaccines. And in his answer, he said, well, by the middle of next year, he said, we will have plenty of vaccines, more than enough to go round.
When we start off with vaccines, I'm always very keen, as with any other drug, is you want to take things a little bit more carefully to begin with, just so you get to know how these things work. So, for example, Dr. Rain talked about the fact that, you know, we were discussing two early cases of things. I mean, she and I were discussing this at 11:30 last night, just to make sure, and you start off, in a sense, doing it in centres where actually you've got all the equipment and everything, and then as you're comfortable with them, you feel you understand them, you move them out, and that's part of the kind of standard way you'd think about safety of things. But the aim would be to roll out this vaccine and then any others that get a licence and are effective and safe. And we expect by the middle of the year probably to have a portfolio of three or four vaccines which we can actually use.
We'll have three or four vaccines that we can use by the middle of next year. I cut that pretty short because he moved on to waffling about something else. By the middle of next year, we'll have a portfolio of three or four vaccines which we can use, said Whitty. When will lockdowns no longer be needed? Chris Whitty was next asked. What did he say?
At what point does Sage recommend actually lockdowns are no longer needed? Has there been conversations on that point?
Well, I'll give a view, and then Patrick will want to give a view. But my view on this is what the vaccine will do for sure, even if it has no onward protection advantage at all, and I think that's unlikely. I think it will probably reduce transmission, but let's assume it doesn't. But what it will do is incrementally, it'll first reduce the mortality rate very substantially, because the mortality is very heavily skewed towards older people. So once you get through that, it'll really substantially reduce it. And then it'll start to reduce the number of people who go into hospital and have severe disease very substantially. And at a certain point, society, through political leaders, through ministers, elected ministers, and through Parliament, will say this level of risk is a level of risk that we think it is appropriate to tolerate, just as we accept that in an average year, 7,000 people a year die of flu, and in a bad flu year, 20,000 people die of flu. That's just, we accept that as that is what happens biologically. And at a certain point, you say, actually, the risk is now low enough that we can largely do away with certainly the most onerous things that we have to deal with. This will happen incrementally. It's not going to be where absolutely everything until one day suddenly you stop. This will be a kind of gradual retreat from that, but it is a de-risking process rather than it's just going to go away. And we will de-risk, hopefully, to a very low level of risk, but I think it's very unlikely we'll get to zero level of risk.
We'll come back to that. And SAGE, the Scientific Advisory Group on Emergencies, will tell the government about the risk.
Now, SAGE can help, and this is where I'll turn to Patrick, can help in saying what level of risk there is. it is ultimately a societal and therefore a political question. What level of risk does the population wish to tolerate relative to the damage that is done to other areas, to the society, to the economy and so on? Those are the difficult choices. We're not there yet. For the next 3 months, I want to be very clear, for the next 3 months we will not have sufficient protection. We're going through the most difficult time of year for respiratory infections and the most difficult time of year for the NHS. So the idea we can suddenly stop now because the vaccine's here, that would be really premature. It's like someone giving up a marathon race at mile 16. It would be absolutely the wrong thing to do.
And if you missed it a moment ago, it's just like the terror threat level. Remember these colour-coded charts? Moderate, severe, imminent, terror. The terror threat level never goes back to unlikely or not expecting a terrorist attack at any time soon. Listen to what he said again.
But it is a de-risking process rather than it's just going to go away. And we will de-risk, hopefully, to a very low level of risk. But I think it's very unlikely we'll get to zero level of risk.
Unlikely to get to zero level of risk, which means, of course, that we expect, and he said this as well, that we'll be living with some level of restrictions for some time to come. And while you've got government ministers like Michael Gove saying, well, we think now we'll be back to normal in the spring, Whitty and Valance and Jean-Claude Van Tam and your man Farrar, Jeremy Farrar, and all these other arseholes that are in the pocket of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they're all saying it's likely that we'll be living with some level of restrictions like masks and social distancing right to the end of 2021. And Jean-Claude Van Tam has been saying that it's Jonathan Van Tam, who is the government's deputy chief medical officer. This arsehole has been saying he thinks really we should keep the masks forever. And he's been backed up by Bharat Pankhani, Exeter University guy. We heard from him on yesterday's programme. They want people to wear masks in the future if they've got a head cold. Why wouldn't you wear a mask if you've got a head cold? Why should you be allowed to get on the tram or the tube or the underground or an airplane? Why should you be able to go to work with a head cold? You should wear a mask. It's here to stay. None of this stuff is going anywhere because it wasn't meant to go anywhere. It's 5.5 minutes to 6 o'clock. Wednesday's programme, December 9th. Let's move on. This is very important. Please give me your complete attention. Very important. I mentioned Michael Gove just there. Government minister, cabinet minister, weasel, rodent-faced little pipsqueak. He was on GMB this morning and he had a spat with Piers Morgan. Piers Morgan comes very close to doing his job here. Very close, but not close enough. Very important little row about herd immunity. Please listen.
Grateful for the clarification. I think it is also the case that it's important that you should clarify that the UK government was never also pursuing a policy.
Well, Patrick Vallance said actually on Radio 4, on record, on tape, that that's exactly what we were doing. And so when you guys say we weren't doing it, why did no one tell the chief scientific advisor? Because he was under the impression that's exactly what we were doing.
Advisors advise, ministers decide. That was never the policy.
You were following the science at the time. Do you remember? You told us every single day we are following the science, not guided by, not listening and making our own decisions. We're doing what the scientists tell us. Your chief scientific advisor on, I think it was March the 16th, on Radio 4, around that week, he said quite unequivocally that we were following herd immunity. And the attempt by the British government to deny what your own chief scientific advisor said on the record then, I'm afraid, will not survive a public inquiry, because he said it on the record on radio.
We were not following a policy of herd immunity.
Why did he say we were?
You will have to ask Sir Patrick, a great man who offers
So he didn't know what policy the government was following, and he's your chief scientific advisor.
Yes, but I'm the minister, and I'm telling you that we were not following a policy.
So you were following the science, but ignoring the science.
Our policy is informed by the science, and one of the reasons.
Yeah, but you said at the time you were following the science. You can't be informed and following it and then ignoring it. It's either one or the other. You're either following it or you're not. I can go back and play 100 clips of ministers saying you were following the science. You said it every single day. Now you're saying the chief scientific advisor had no idea what he was talking about and was talking about a policy that none of you were following.
No, I'm not saying that he had no idea what he was talking about. He knows a great deal more about these issues than a number of commentators. But the whole point is that when you receive scientific advice, you weigh it against a number of different considerations.
So he advised you to pursue herd immunity and you said no. Is that the new position?
No. It is the case that scientific advisers and other advisers lay out a range of facts and a range of options, and they allow ministers to look at that.
Do you see why I said this is hugely important? And do you see why I said Piers Morgan came very close to doing his job? Hugely important. Now, you and I know that back in early March, Patrick Vallance, the government's chief scientific advisor, one half of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, I'm not sure whether he's Tweedledum or Tweedledee, anyway, he told Radio 4 and Sky News, it might have been March 9th, it might have been March 13th, I can't remember, but he told Radio 4 and he told Sky News that you can't suppress the virus, nor should you, nor should you. He said herd immunity meant that a large percentage of the population would get the virus and recover quickly, with only mild symptoms, meaning the virus effectively dissipates over time. He really said those things. So some people got very excited when Piers Morgan started asking Michael Gove about not following the scientists. The listeners or the viewers might have been forgiven for thinking that Piers Morgan was finally going to do his job and tell the truth and say, why have we had all this lockdown and all this misery and all this job loss and all this mental health crisis and ruining children's lives? Why? When back in the very early days of this nonsense, the scientists were saying, well, let's just treat this the way we treat any normal virus. But of course, Morgan didn't do that. He wanted to grandstand with Michael Gove. This is Vallance on Radio 4 back in March.
To try and reduce the peak, broaden the peak, not to suppress it completely. Also, because most people, the vast majority of people, get a mild illness, to build up some degree of herd immunity as well, so that more people are immune to this disease and we reduce the transmission. At the same time, we protect those who are most vulnerable from it. Those are the key things we need to do.
Yes, and he went into even more detail on the very same morning on Sky News with Stephen Dixon.
So we want to suppress it, not get rid of it completely, which you can't do anyway, not suppress it so we get the second peak, and also allow enough of us who are going to get mild illness to become immune to this to help with the sort of whole population response, which would protect everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that herd immunity, I know you talked about yesterday when you were appearing with the Prime Minister. In terms of building up a herd immunity within the UK, what sort of percentage of people need to have contracted the virus?
Probably about 60% or so. And we think that this virus is likely to be one that comes back year on year, become like a seasonal virus, and communities will become immune to it. And that's going to be an important part of controlling this longer term.
Imagine that. Imagine that. We know this, but the vast majority of people in this country do not know this. So here's the chief scientific advisor, and he says, got to let people get this virus. They'll get it. They won't feel too bad. They'll get over it, and we'll build up a natural herd immunity. Now, 5 minutes after he came off of Sky News in March, his phone rang. Brr, 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 brr. Hello, Patrick Vallance. It was Bill Gates.
You stupid, ignorant son of a bitch, dumb bastard! Jesus Christ, I've met some dumb bastards in my time, but you outdo them all.
That's right. That was Bill Gates phoning Patrick Vallance. You stupid, ignorant son of a bitch, dumb bastard! We're telling people these days that the only way to achieve herd immunity is through vaccination, Patrick. Vaccination. Right? And then the penny dropped. And since then, the government and Sage have declared that herd immunity can only be reached through the wonderful thing that is vaccination. Right. You stupid, ignorant son of a bitch, dumb bastard. Right, it's exactly 2 minutes past six. You are with the BBG. This is Headlines from FSN. Back with a tune, maybe, in a minute. Back with a tune. Got some Buddy Holly.
From FSN in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts with the latest world headlines. Two healthcare workers in Britain had an allergic reaction to the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine on the first day of its rollout. Brexit talks between the UK and the EU on a final deal before Britain leaves the EU for good on December 31st are proving elusive. And COVID-19 cases in the United States have topped 15 million, with intensive care beds nearing capacity across the country.
Thank you, Nina Maria, there in Washington, D.C. Good to hear from you. Got lots more to come, I think. It's 3 minutes past six, Wednesday's programme, the 9th of December. We're 16 days from the baby Jesus, Christmas Day. A day beloved by the travellers all over the world, eh? What am I doing here? I have no idea. Oh, be Jesus. Right, what was I going to do? I was going to tell you about Christmas morning. I told you yesterday. Before I go any further, can you do me a favour, can you? I saw something that boiled my piss on Facebook this morning. I wanted to track down the person who posted it, and I wanted to beat the ever-living granny out of him. Then I thought that might be an overreaction. He asked me, where's the YouTube videos? Why is it that so many of you are just not up to date on current affairs? What the fuck is wrong with some of you? Let me say it again. YouTube has been deleting some of my videos. And they've punished the BBG. They've flagellated the BBG. They've told me that I cannot upload for another 2 weeks. I've said this repeatedly. I've also made videos explaining to people how to listen to the programme. It's live, by the way. Very few things are these days. It's a live radio show. Averaging 130,000 to 140,000 listeners per show. Averaging, by the way. 5 million unique downloads of the podcast a month. By the way, there's 1,000 ways to listen to the programme. You lazy bastards. And your YouTube. So I say to the likes of the great Spiros Skouras, who might be listening, and to anybody else who's got a huge following on YouTube, the next time you're making a video about the coronavirus or anything else, please just drop in. Richie Allen is no longer on YouTube. The penny might drop with some of these feckin' backstards eventually, I don't know. Anyway, Christmas morning, I'll be with you for 2 hours between 10 and midday. I won't be playing Christmas songs exclusively. I'll have some lovely songs from yesteryear, a bit like Sunday morning melodies. We'll have a chat, me and you. I promise there will be one or two surprises. It'll be worth your while. If you're in Central European time or if you're in Greenwich Mean Time, it might suit you as you're basting the turkey or whatever it is you do on Christmas morning. I'll keep you company for a couple of hours anyway. All will be fun. And tomorrow night, I will be speaking to a different audience. I've been invited to be interviewed by Hayden Hewitt on Trigger Warning. That's tomorrow at 9 o'clock Thursday. Of course, the Richie Allen Radio Show will be on tomorrow as normal. In fact, Gerald Salente will join me, last time this year. But tomorrow night at 9, I'll be at the Trigger Warning Studios. Listen at youtube.com/triggerwarningTV. Follow Hayden Hewitt on Twitter for the details. I will be talking to a different audience. I've got plenty to say. It should be very interesting indeed. Here's Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly. That'll be the day. Buddy Holly of Buddy Holly and the Crickets. You might not know, died in a plane crash. Terrible thing. Terrible thing. When Piers Morgan was haranguing Michael Gove about Patrick Vallance, when Vallance said herd immunity can be achieved by allowing people to go about their business and get the virus, that shows to me what a snivelling, cowardly bastard of a presenter Piers Morgan is. Because he must know that he stumbled on the conspiracy. that the pandemic is a hoax, as well as treating it when there's an infection going around, we ordinarily allow that infection spread in the less vulnerable, which is the majority of people, because that's how you reach herd immunity. Why did Vallance say that back then? That's the question Piers Morgan isn't asking. He isn't asking that. Why did Vallance say that back then? Why change your mind? Why is the government saying we can't let the virus rip? Who reined in Patrick Vallance? Did he get that call from Billy Poisonjabs, calling him a stupid bastard? I don't know. Why did the government ignore that advice? Piers Morgan won't go there. And I mentioned at the top of the programme, Good Morning Britain ran a sickening poll today on Twitter, which is still running, asking should the unvaccinated be banned from public places. Charlie Mullins of Pimlico Plumbers told Good Morning Britain, yes, not only should they be banned, but Pimlico Plumbers wouldn't be serving the unvaccinated. Here's Charlie Mullins.
I find most people are going to want to have it, and I think it's going to become a standard thing across the country that people have been vaccinated, and if they're not vaccinated, not going to be able to travel, not going to be able to go in gyms, theatres, and maybe even in the workplace. So I don't think I'm saying anything that's not common sense.
Okay, but if I wanted to call out Pimlico Plumbers and I was pregnant, for instance, not in my plans, but if I was, would you refuse to send a plumber to my home? Because currently, as I understand it, pregnant women are being advised not to get the vaccine.
Yeah, well, look, there's obviously exceptions and you can't force anyone to have it. But I'm saying is that, you know, I think it's going to be important to protect customers and their members of staff when they're going out to visit jobs. So if the standard thing is to have it, then that's the inquiry we've been
making. How would you feel, Charlie, if you weren't allowed to go to, say, a restaurant without a vaccine certificate or a pub?
I feel they're totally right. They're running a business. It's killed over 60,000 people in the UK, destroyed many people's life. We found a silver bullet for the cure of it. We need to take it.
Oh, Charlie, I hope you drown in a fat man's toilet, you.
You junkies bastard, yeah.
Exactly, Simi. I couldn't think of what to say about Charlie Mullins. I hope you drown in a toilet. We're not going to serve anybody who doesn't have the jab. And the pubs and the restaurants should turn away people. Baxter. 12 minutes past six. How you doing, by the way? If you've just joined me, you haven't missed much, really. BBG with you till around about 6:30 today. I will have Gerald Celente at least with me tomorrow. Probably have a couple of guests tomorrow. Lots to talk about today. Still, I think, pupils are being forced to eat their school lunches, including mashed potatoes, with their hands in a school in Walsall. I'm guessing you heard this. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. This is the truth. Pupils are being forced to use their hands to eat potatoes, mashed potatoes, because the headmaster banned cutlery as cutlery is a COVID risk. Pupils at Edgar Stammers Primary School are basically eating finger food for their lunches.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Amy, they've got a plate of mashed potatoes and they're eating it with their hands because the headmaster took away the forks and the knives. Nick Ferrari from LBC Radio. Well, he couldn't Adam and Eve it. Here he is.
At a primary school, the Edgar Stammers Primary School, they've decided that children now will eat their food without cutlery. It is a primary school, so this is obviously ages 4 through 11. The pupils are given grab bags, told they must wash their hands before and after eating. Here's the food that's being served up that you have to eat with your fingers. Pasta, Yorkshire pudding, and mashed potato with your fingers, and you're a child. This is madness, isn't it?
Madness.
I'll tell you what the school is saying. One mum, Georgina Fensom, who has two children in year 3 and 5, tells the Daily Telegraph, I think they've treated our children like animals. How can you expect your children to eat dinner without a knife and fork? It's a basic human right. It's nuts, isn't it?
It's a basic human right. The law offices of Gareth Pearce will be inundated with phone calls from Walsall, with mummies and daddies asking Gareth Pearce to go to the European Court of Human Rights because little Johnny and little Mary didn't have a knife and fork at lunchtime. Jesus. Got funnier, though, because Nick Ferrari interviewed Francis Gilbert. Francis is a teacher trainer and an author of a book on how to be a teacher. What does Francis Gilbert think of the little kiddies being forced to use their grubby little paws to eat their lunches to stop the spread of COVID?
Well, it's very difficult to tell. I mean, I am very reluctant to sort of, you know, dive in there and know the actual complete situation, but it seems to me that they are possibly experimenting with, you know, reducing the transmission of C19 through this, and it, you know, I think it's kind of sounds like it's worth a go.
What, to have a 5-year-old eat mashed potato with his or her hand fingers?
it's from what I can see, this is about the health and safety of the children, isn't it?
It's health and safety,
isn't it? And making sure that they're not infected.
You're
with
telling
virus
me
or
that a child's hands are safer to consume pasta and mashed potato than a plastic spoon or fork?
Well, this may be the current thinking. I'm not a medical expert.
I appreciate
that. I'm just kind of coming in and saying, hang on a minute, we don't know the full circumstances of the case, and I'm reluctant to get involved in teacher bashing over this.
I'm not teacher bashing. I'm bashing the, and we'll tell you what the chief executive of the school says in just a moment. But look, you've worked with more children than I have. Do you honestly think that every child's hands are going to be scrupulously clean when they start diving into the pasta and mashed potatoes? You and I both know they're not. They should buy 5,000 plastic spoons and forks and knives or whatever they need. No?
Well, we don't know.
Mr. Gilbert, what do you need to know? ask me what you need to know about this story. You keep saying we don't know. What don't you know? I don't get it.
I think the key thing for me, I would kind of raise another point, is that it's not necessarily a bad thing to eat your food with your hands.
Mashed potato.
Culturally acceptable in...
We're in Walsall.
Many other countries.
We're in Walsall eating mashed potato. We're not in Delhi eating curry. We're in Walsall eating a mashed potato, Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Gilbert. Take that, Mr. Gilbert. Thinks of the best for you. Bend over. Grab your ankles. There's a good boy. Yeah, that's real. My great pal in Cleggan says to me, "You're making it up, aren't you?" No. No. The head teacher decided forks and knives spread coronavirus. So you'll eat with your hands, you little bastards. And Mr. Gilbert came on and said, "Well, might be new thinking. We can't bash the school or bash the teachers. It's 17 minutes past the hour. Welcome, if you've just joined the programme, this is the Richie Allen Radio Show Madness." John says to me, "Richie, my youngest son, who's 7, told me that he had a cheese whirl and salad in a bag for dinner. Yum." You see, school lunches is an alien concept to a boy from Ballybeg in Waterford City, because the primary school and the secondary school I went to didn't serve food. You had to have your own. You brought in your own packed lunch made by mummy. Some of my packed lunches were just, well, they were, well, amazing. Banana sandwiches. Who the fuck ever came up with the concept of banana sandwiches? My banana sandwiches were particularly awful, I suppose, for most people, because I have never been partial to butter. I don't like butter, don't like cheese, don't like any dairy thing. Makes me ill. Giving away my weakness now, like Superman and Kryptonite. I don't like butter, so I would have banana sandwiches. And of course, the banana sandwiches are packed in tin foil, which is bad for you anyway. And by the time you get to lunchtime and your school bag is hanging on the coat rack, which is near the radiator in the classroom, the smell of banana would make the person with the strongest stomach ever run to the bowl, scream into that big porcelain telephone, banana sandwiches, crisp sandwiches. She used to do sardine sandwiches. That was a luxury, sardine sandwiches. And in Ireland, we're partial to luncheon meat, which in the UK, you'll know what luncheon meat is. Luncheon meat is basically bits of every animal that was ever murdered on a farm and bits of wood shavings and everything else thrown in, bits of old rubber boots and stuff. So you'd have luncheon meat. That was your packed lunch. So it's an alien concept to me, school dinners. I know the kids pay for them. Am I right in saying that? In the UK, they do pay for them. At least the kids who can afford to pay for them do pay for them. 20 minutes past the hour. St. Saviour's National School in Ballybeg. Great place to go to school. So it was back in the day. Now, Margaret Hodge, or Dame Margaret Hodge, is a Labour Party MP. She has said the government must ban online anonymity or make social media directors personally liable for defamatory posts. Revealing today, Margaret Hodge, that she gets tens of thousands of abusive tweets a month. God love her. Hodge accused the government of deliberately delaying the online harms bill in order to avoid difficult conversations with powerful social media companies. Hodge said she was prepared to step up, take a campaign, and make sure the law was tough enough. Here's Margaret Hodge speaking to Politics Live today on online anonymity and why it needs to go.
And then there's this issue of anonymity, which is really, really difficult. I have had 90,000 in the last 2 months of mentions online since really the publication of the report on anti-Semitism by the EHRC. Some of them are really deeply abusive. It's like an Orwellian mission that is designed to undermine me, undermine my credibility, silence me, and stop anybody believing what I say, particularly if I'm talking about anti-Semitism. And much of that is anonymous.
Right.
Now, I know this is really difficult because people argue that social media is a platform where you can have democratic debate, where whistleblowers can come in, where people who are subject to domestic violence can come in. But that anonymity hides real harm.
All right.
And I think probably the way through it is to make the social media companies responsible for knowing the identity of everybody who uses their platforms. And then if there is real harm from an individual, that they individual can be identified.
Here comes some language unbecoming. Margaret Hodge is a horrible, evil bastard in every sense of the word. How dare Margaret Hodge complain about receiving the occasional abusive tweet, whether occasional means five or six or a thousand. This is the woman, Margaret Hodge, who, when she was leader of Islington Council, willfully and knowingly covered up horrendous child sex abuse in care homes that she was responsible for. I invent none of this. Hodge was told by whistleblowers. Hodge was told by a fantastic journalist at the London Evening Standard, a guy called Stuart Stephen, at the horrific abuses that were going on. Torture. Alleged murder of children, child prostitution. Hodge knew it was going on. Why didn't she do anything about it? You'd have to ask Margaret Hodge. And you complain about social media abuse. One of the women who was ripped to pieces, whose body was permanently injured as a result of the abuse, was called names and libeled by Hodge, calling her seriously disturbed. Years later, Hodge had to give the woman £10,000 in damages. Why did Hodge do nothing about the abuse happening in care homes when she knew it was going on? Margaret Hodge is a filthy, dirty bastard of a human being. a liar. I'm not going to say any more. I'm not going to get into the Friends of Israel and the Jeremy Corbyn allegations. I'm not going to get into any of that. A vile, disgusting human being talking about the need for online anonymity to end. Listen, I get as much abuse as anybody, and you know that last year some of the abuse that I took got so serious that the police had to be involved. When people were putting my address online and urging people to come and see me. And I wouldn't demand that everybody who holds a Facebook or a Twitter account give their real name and address to Twitter or Facebook or to the government. I wouldn't demand it. Awful, Margaret Hodge. On the same programme, a broadcaster called Timandra Harkness disagrees. Timandra Harkness. Where was the priest at that christening? I christen you, Timandra. Stop the ceremony. Which of the fucking parents came up with this ridiculous name? Timandra Harkness. Jesus, upper classes, eh? Here she is responding to it. She's a broadcaster.
But like so many of these things, you've got a problem and a thing that people shouldn't do. And then there's the question of what you do about it. I mean, I'm very glad to hear Margaret Hodge distinguish between the request to abolish anonymity like directly face to face, because I think some people call for nobody to ever be anonymous online so that you always have to use your real name and identity. And I think that's really problematic because exactly the kind of abuse that Margaret's been getting can then be directed at people using their own real names, as Margaret does and I do. And some in some cases that can have terrible consequences. So a lot of people are anonymous online for really good reason, that either they are at risk of losing their job or there are threats and threats against their families. So I think for people to be able to be anonymous online often is the only condition of their being able to take part in public debate. The question of whether people should have to make their true identity known to the social media platforms, I think is a bit more difficult because we are talking here about, as Margaret Hodge noted, very powerful international corporations with a lot of power, indirect and direct, over our own lives. Often they collect data in one place about us and use it somewhere else. So a lot of us wouldn't necessarily even be happy about those companies knowing about what we do, what we say and what we think in our own names, because it might be used in some other context.
Well said. Well said. Good girl. Absolutely right. Nearly done now. There was some good news today. I don't know if you saw the good news. Zara Tyndall, she's the Queen's granddaughter, she is. And Mike, her husband Mike, who played for England, rugby player, seems to be a nice fella. Mike Tyndall, obviously, Richie. She used to be, had a brain freeze there. She was Zara Phillips, wasn't she? I'm not a royalist now. God, no, I'm an Irish nationalist, of course. No time for him. But news that Zara is expecting baby number 3. And it's newsworthy today because she had 2 miscarriages in the past. Heaven help her, or any woman that happens to. They're saying she was very stoic about it. She said, keep it to yourself, and or you do keep it to yourself and you try and get on with things when it happens to you. Maybe there's a dig there at Meghan, the actress, in Los Angeles, maybe not. I've always been partial to a bit of Zara Phillips, to be honest. It's the jodhpurs and the knee-high riding boots. That's my fetish. I've said this on the radio before. I'm completely shameless. I'm shameless and blameless. I'm proud of myself. I'm out and proud. Jodhpurs and knee-high riding boots shined to a nice gloss. Imagine that. Guys are watching violent, ugly pornography today. And there's old Baldy. Show me some jodhpurs and riding boots, and I'm yours. So long as you're a cisgender woman, that is. Did you see that story in the Daily Mail earlier in the week? A bloke on the West Midlands police force over 20 years gets up one morning, throws on a wig and a blouse and says, I'm a woman now. I'm a woman, I'm a lady now. You're under arrest, I tell you. Ah, be Jesus. That's it from the BBG for Wednesday. Look after yourselves and one another. I love you. See you tomorrow. Bye now. We have